Let's see if we can get to our fine former U.S. Attorney, James Santel. I think he's joining us right now. Jim, welcome back to the Devil's Advocates.
Mike, good to be with you, even through the miracles of modern technology this afternoon.
Oh, man, it's a Friday. It was bound to happen sometime this week. Jim, always great when you join us. I don't know if you heard what I was discussing, but did you see Jamie Raskin's statement overnight, specifically regarding Mike Pence and the fact that he refused to get into the car provided to him on January 6th? And I was troubled by the thought, the vice president's in the Capitol building being overrun by domestic terrorists chanting "Hang Mike Pence," and posed with a getaway car, one must think. Mike Pence said, "I'm not getting in the car." Jim, that doesn't add up under any other circumstance. I mean, I don't know if he had some insight. I mean, obviously he was under pressure from the former president, Pence was. He knew they were trying to pressure him. And I know that, I guess, technically, if he'd have left the building, they wouldn't have been able to, what, certify under the terms of the Constitution if the VP's out of the building. But the fact that he wouldn't get in the car, Jim, means he was at the docks, the loading docks at the Capitol building. He never left the building. He was hiding there. And my understanding, I thought we'd seen prior reporting that the Oath Keeper, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and others use that very same location as a rendezvous point. It's almost like they suspected someone to be there, Jim. Did you see the reporting on Raskin, and what was your gut reaction to it?
Right. I did see it briefly. I didn't delve into it in the great detail that I probably should have. But, you know, a few reactions. One is, of course, it underscores, again, the complete lack of control in this entire situation, right? Even the fact we're talking about this, we've got a vice president of the United States of America whose life is in danger. Where? In the United States Capitol. How dramatic, how stunning is that? Then refusing to get into a car. And one of my reactions is again, I use the expression head scratcher way too much, but this is yet another one of those. In situations where the security of the attorney general, of the president, the vice president, someone in a position of responsibility is in jeopardy. I'm not saying you have no decision-making capacity under those circumstances, but it's the decision then of the FBI agent, of the Secret Service agent, and it's their responsibility to keep you safe. And I have been in situations, not myself threatened, but with the attorney general and others, where the answer is the security makes a decision here. We're going to keep you safe. We're going to keep you secure. And with all due respect, you do not have that discretion to make that judgment call. So when I saw this report again about a decision he's making, I recognize he is the vice president and probably has some political reasons for making the choice that he did. Nonetheless, it strikes me as a very, very odd exchange, a very peculiar event in the midst of absolute meltdown, and one that we need more details about to understand it further. I think it is something that should be delved into, plainly will be explored more by the media.
Jim, Raskin stated that Pence's Secret Service agents were in communications with the White House, the Secret Service of Donald Trump. So, you know, it leads me to believe that Pence's whereabouts were being monitored at the White House by Trump's Secret Service, as would be appropriate, except, you know, if there's a coup plot and the vice president's the linchpin thereof. Now, Jim, we've talked a couple times about Michael Flynn. And Michael Flynn was the former NSC director or whatever the case may be. He was accused of lying to the vice president, eventually fired from his position, charged, convicted, and pardoned, if I recall. But one of the things he was alleged to have done was he was supposed to render a Turkish cleric. They were going to go kidnap a guy, Jim. And you know, it seems beyond the pale. This seems like a Hollywood story. But to me, Jim, this is an implication by Jamie Raskin that perhaps the vice president was the target of a kidnapping plot, if not to, you know, take him and hold him for ransom. At least they wanted him off the reservation against his own will.
This is, again, why this is so peculiar, because under any other circumstance, as I said, the security folks would make that call. And frankly, even an elected official would say, all right, I need to do this because you're the experts. Here, the fact that the vice president, who does have the authority to do it, overruled his security folks at a time of great calamity, a great threat to everyone, and said, no, I'm not getting in that car. Now, again, he may have said, no, I don't want to be abandoning this operation. I don't want to be vacating this important constitutional site right now with respect to the counting of the electoral votes. There may have been part of that as well. But we do need to know more. And this is the reason why it would be very good for someone, I'm sure someone has spoken to the vice president, even privately, to quiz him on exactly what he was doing, what he was thinking, and what his concerns were at the time. It does sound exactly like something out of a Tom Clancy novel. But again, every experience that we've had in the past, not year, but previous 4 years, has been just when you think it's unbelievable, it's true. And again, we don't know what happened here. We're not ready to say that. But this extraordinary weirdness where, again, the vice president overrules the people keeping him safe and secure, saying, I'm going to stay here, could have a justification independent of some greater concern. But maybe he did know something else about the extent to which he himself was in jeopardy beyond just the people who were attacking the Capitol.
Folks, you are listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Got a favored guest, friend of the devil, James Santel, former U.S. attorney. Jim, there's a civil case underway against the former president being brought by congresspeople like Eric Swalwell, my understanding. I believe former Capitol Police Officer Michael Fanone is involved in the civil cases. And back in February, a federal judge ruled in the civil case that effectively, not that, you know, it's not a conviction of, you know, it's a civil case, but there's enough evidence to allow it to proceed. Effectively, what is being stated by this federal judge is it's not implausible that there's a conspiracy between the president of the United States at the time, Donald Trump, and groups like the Proud Boys and others. And that judge took note of the fact they had a specific track record of violence in D.C. against Capitol cops. They'd done it in November. They'd done it in December. And despite Donald Trump said, you know, come to D.C. on January 6th, it'll be wild. That is a much bigger plot, I think, than simply saying go march to the Capitol. I mean, we're talking about perhaps purposefully engaging these militia groups to be the violent tool of the insurrection. And Jim, it's not much of a leap from there to think, well, hell, what if they could grab up the vice president? There were plenty of them that showed up with zip ties and gallows, Jim.
Right, right. We've got not only these horrific visual images, the behavior itself, which is cataclysmic, but now you have, as you indicated, judges, several of them making findings about what should in fact be done with respect to criminal prosecution. Here we know about the case in California as well involving John Eastman, finding that the president almost certainly engaged in criminal behavior. Your particular a case you're citing is of the same ilk, if you will. You've got a judge who's saying, you know what, under any other circumstances, I would make a finding perhaps on something called summary judgment that there's no there, that there's just no basis at all for this to proceed. I'm going to dismiss this case. I've got no scintilla of evidence to suggest that this is true. Here, again, there's not a verdict, as you indicated. It's certainly not a criminal matter, but he's looking at the evidence he's got in front of him and saying, you know what, this is a possibility. This is plausible, and this is not a frivolous argument that's been making by these plaintiffs, that in fact there was something of a conspiracy. We don't know whether or not there was a full meeting of the minds here, but that the fact that once again a sworn federal district court judge with evidence, presumably also in form of affidavits and statements, looks at this and says, I'm not going to dismiss this. I'm going to let this go ahead. More discovery, perhaps a trial down the road. That, too, indicates that the reason to be greatly concerned about the possibilities of conspiracies, again, as we've talked, simply agreements between people to engage in an illegal end. We know that there have been conspiracies surrounding this. These events for a very long period of time. It has many tendrils, and that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get your hands around it. So many people doing so many things, all of which could be a part of this larger plot, everybody doing their own thing, if you will.
Jim Sentell, let's talk about one of the sort of meaty tendrils. Alex Jones reportedly is seeking immunity to give testimony on what he may know about January 6th. And what I understand is Alex Jones was at the Willard Hotel on January 5th, you know, and January 6th. He was at Trump Command Central, effectively, for this control, or at least it's speculated, they were controlling the actions or they were monitoring the actions of the violent insurrection from the Willard Hotel. But Alex Jones is one that has been personally involved with, I forget if it's the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys, but I mean, he had a specific relationship with those groups. And we now know that some of these leaders of these groups have been charged with the most serious crimes related to January 6th, seditious conspiracy. So the conspiracy is already being alleged. If Alex Jones was aware of the conspiracy, Jim, what is the likelihood that the DOJ is going to extend immunity to a guy like Alex Jones? I mean, he'd have to put a lot of people in jail to walk away scot-free, would he not, sir?
Absolutely. And this is my reaction to that when I first saw it, is you've got a lot of attorneys inside the Department of Justice, assistant U.S. attorneys, folks in the criminal division, other sections of Maine Justice, thinking very, very carefully before they go down this road for a couple of reasons. And that's the first one, which is you always make this determination about whether or not this particular person, first of all, can provide you with information that truly is relevant. You want to make certain that they are credible. That's another problem, obviously, with Alex Jones when it comes to bringing him in. What is his or her own culpability? You don't want to be giving immunity to somebody who, frankly, should be charged. All those things have got to be in the mix. A very, very limited capacity here to go ahead right now and give him immunity.
James Intel, my fine guest. Stick around. You could be part of the mix. 844-967-2789.
We have to bring back law and order.
Those are f***ing fighting words.
Make it public, girl.
Catching up after work.
Guys, this round's on me. All
right. What? You stupid.
You said that? You really said that?
I knew. You should have just seen it. Like, you should have been.
Getting back to the moments we miss starts with getting informed. Get the latest info about COVID-19 vaccines at getvaccineanswers.org. It's up to you. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Just a little bits and pieces. Again, same kind of headline reading. Again, all of this kind of testimony strikes me as being, number one, unmistakably self-serving, right? Obviously, you've got a message to convey there. And in the end, as others have done, spent most of my career trying to figure out what the facts are, what the truth is, and getting to what is truly intent, what is in someone's mind, what's going on, what are the facts of the case. I look at what I've seen there, and I don't see an exposition of truth. I don't see an exposition of things that can be relied upon by a finder of fact to come to a conclusion. And again, that's why this testimony is, like other kinds of testimony that we've seen, not especially helpful, but also not entirely surprising either in its content and its demeanor.
Well, Jim, it reminded me a lot of Alberto Gonzalez with all the I don't recalls and I don't remembers, the former AG failing to give any sort of real testimony in regards to why he fired all the U.S. attorneys once upon a time. MTG, similar, I don't recall. I mean, that was basically her answer for anything. Well, that's your Twitter account. That's your face. That's your video. That's you, right? I don't recall. I mean, it was a laughable circumstance, Jim. And at one point, the courtroom laughed. I mean, she was accused of stealing movie lines from Independence Day. And, you know, perhaps that was the only allegation where I maybe believed her when she said, I don't recall.
Right. And, I think back on my own practice, and I don't know that I have ever counseled. We don't rehearse witnesses. We certainly don't tell them what to say. But it's sort of generally known out there that if you don't want to perjure yourself, if you don't want to lie under oath, one of the things you can do is you can say, I don't know. It's about to say, I don't recall that I've ever encouraged a witness. I don't think any of my colleagues have encouraged a witness, obviously, to say that as a way of masking the truth. But that, I think, is what she's doing. And it's sort of generally known out there that if you don't want to be subject to a prosecution for lying, you say, I simply can't remember. Why? Because it's hard to allege that you in fact, are lying about not remembering, right? That's a tough thing to show.
But, Jim, contrast that with her testimony when she was being directed by her attorney, James Bopp. He would direct her, oh, yeah, what time do you send out that tweet? 2:38 p.m. on January 6th. I mean, she was very detailed in her memories when questioned by her counsel. I found it quite ironic. She didn't recall any of the other people's questions, though. None of that could she answer.
And that goes to her credibility, right? Triers of fact look at that and say, okay, that portion of it, you knew the questions were coming. You have at least been prepared by your attorney. That's appropriate to do. And now all of a sudden, when you're confronted with all these other things that on their face are clear, suddenly you don't remember, you don't recall. And that goes to your credibility, right? You're basically lying. It goes to the point I was making before, which is your statement that I don't recall. You recall all these other things. You don't recall this. There's a wonderful jury instruction that says that, you know, you can assess the credibility of a witness based upon her or his entire corpus of testimony, all the things that they have said. You bring all of that to the mix. You analyze all this together, and you determine whether or not they're to be believed in whole, in part, or not at all. And I think in the end, given this divergence, as you say, and this obfuscation attempt, that she plainly was pursuing, I would look at that, as I said before. I don't see anything of credibility that adds to the trier of fact's capacity to understand what really went on here.
Now, having said all that, Jim, and I watched this lady lie her way through testimony. I mean, most evasive testimony I've ever seen. And I still think it's an ill-fated attempt to keep her off the ballot. It's just the only one proceeding. I see a Maricopa County judge in Arizona, like a local judge, basically said, we're not the right venue to keep Biggs and Gozar off the Arizona ballot. The efforts here in the state of Wisconsin are going through the federal courts. We'll see how that works out. But the efforts of Madison Cawthorn to keep him off the ballot in North Carolina have been blocked by a federal Trump appointee who said, you know, there's another act that basically forgave all the prior insurrectionists. So that's like in perpetuity. That's a ridiculous conclusion. But until there is a conviction of some specific politician, be it Madison Cawthorn, MTG, Ron Johnson, I don't see how you effectively use the 14th Amendment to keep him off the ballot, Jim. I admire the effort. I just don't even think the timeline is feasible.
Right. There are lots of things we've talked about before. 14th Amendment, obviously, the language is fairly clear. One of the questions is, what venue do you go to? There are those scholars out there who think that the Congress should be the one that enforces that, right, and makes the decisions about whether or not this particular candidate should, in fact, be qualified, be a possible member of Congress, a member of the United States Senate. Plainly, these recent attempts, administrative and now in the courts, under the notion that judges should decide whether or not there is, in fact, a finding under the 14th Amendment that you should no longer be a possible representative. But to your larger point, there is some importance about precedent, right? And if you do, in fact, get a judge at some point who says, you know what, I'm taking that language from the 14th Amendment, I'm applying it here, I'm making reference to the things that have been presented to me about what this particular candidate said and did on or about January 6th, and makes that finding, plainly subject to appeal, a lot of argument, discussion, until you get that first precedent out there, there is a great reluctance, I think you're right, to go down this road and open up this area where, frankly, once again, we haven't written a lot, if at all, as an American nation about how we do that. You have to have that first judge out there who's going to say that, and then that changes things. Then I think it does establish a bit of precedent, maybe not regarded by everybody, but it gives you some sense of that 14th Amendment language has some meaning, and people looking at this factually will interpret those facts to prohibit a candidacy.
Jim Santel, the wannabe Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, was accused by the New York Times of some tough talk on Trump. He's going to go and try to force him to resign. And McCarthy said, I didn't say that. And then the reporters went on Rachel Maddow last night and brought the audio tape. Jim, of course, it's not illegal to lie and say, I didn't say that, not unless you got your hand on a Bible or you're in a court of law. But it certainly speaks to the credibility of Kevin McCarthy. And it's got to make some of these future witnesses wonder, do they have tapes on me? We got like 45 seconds left, Jim. Final thoughts on McCarthy.
Sure. A disaster for him should be. But let's step back. Not only lying, obviously, in the very story that's being told, right? I never said that. And then it turns out, in fact, I did. That's hugely problematic. But it goes to this larger issue about, can we rely upon politicians to be honest with us? And if he's lying about something like this, what else can we believe? Frankly, the Republican Party says that January 6th was a legitimate political discourse. Is there any reason to believe that those people really believe that either? And if so, why are they credible on so many different things? That's the problem with the Kevin McCarthy testimony here.
Well, Jim Santel, I always believe you. Fine former U.S. attorney, friend of ours. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Always a pleasure, Mike. Good to see you again.
I'm holding you in contempt of court.